It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, it's the ultimate restaurant guide. Where do top chefs eat on their night off? Well, Karen Page and Andrew Dornenberg interviewed over 100 of them to write Chef's Night Out. Jane and Michael Stern are licking up some sensational frozen custard in Wisconsin. We have a Copenhagen report from Travel and Leisure magazine's Anya von Bremsen. Evidently, it's one big hip designer showroom with food to match. We have another take on travel. A woman who bicycled from Russia to Vietnam tells us about hospitality in Mongolia. Then, for a little contrast, it's how Food & Wine magazine chooses their best new American chefs. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first this. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with Kitchen Chronicles, where knowledge is power and cooking is pleasure. A practical guide for nourishing ourselves and the people we care about. Today, let's talk about asparagus. Talk about a spring vegetable. Nothing says early spring like asparagus. Now, I'm not counting the ones we see all through the winter. Personally, I don't want to eat asparagus at Thanksgiving dinner. Come on, this is a spring vegetable. It's one of the ways we know spring's coming. Besides, buying asparagus in season is cheaper and they taste better. Let's face it. Shipping does not improve a vegetable. The shorter the time between when it's on the plant and when it's on your table, the better. Better tasting and better for you. So if you can, buy from local farmers and buy in season. Now, another great thing about eating in season is you get prime flavor. And just when you're getting a little tired of, let's say, asparagus, their season's over and it's time for something new. For those of us who don't have much time to cook and are trying to cut back on calories, you should know that asparagus cook fast, they taste good hot or cold, they're fat-free, and they're low in calories. And you can do a lot with asparagus. Let's start with how to buy them. Then we'll go on to how to cook them, and then finally some ideas for seasoning. Buy organic if you can. Take home only asparagus that are upright and crisp with tightly closed tips. Forget anything that's tired looking. Now, I like pencil slim asparagus. You'll see them mainly at the beginning and the end of the season. They don't need the peeling that the thick ones do. They're elegant, they cook fast, and they cook evenly. Now, let me explain what I mean. With really thick asparagus, by the time the center of the stalk is properly cooked, the outside can be bordering on mushy. Not what I want to eat. With thin asparagus, the surface and the interior are always about the same. One other thing, and this is the most important thing when buying asparagus, is to make sure that they're all the same thickness, so they'll cook evenly. On to cooking. If your asparagus are close to a half inch thick or more, peel them with a vegetable peeler, stroking away from their tips. Break off the tough ends by bending and letting the break happen naturally. There are lots of ways to cook asparagus. You could stand them up in a tall coffee pot with the stems in about 3 inches of boiling water. Now, this way, the thicker stems simmer while the delicate tops just steam. A microwave works too, and so does a large skillet filled with boiling water. You just spread the asparagus out in it and cook away. Grilled or roasted asparagus are sensational. Just coat them lightly with a little olive oil, a little salt and pepper, and cook. The thin ones are done in about 4 minutes on a grill and in about 10 minutes in a hot oven. Now, what I mean by hot is 450 degrees. No matter how you cook them, the test for doneness is always the same. Pierce the asparagus stem with a knife. If there's a little softening but they're still pretty crisp, stop the cooking immediately. They'll seem underdone, but the residual heat will finish them off. Now for seasoning. Grilled or roasted asparagus take to light mustardy vinaigrettes or some sherry vinegar. Their browned quality is a good foil for the clean, sweet tastes of new potatoes, for instance. You could arrange the asparagus in clusters with slices of steamed potatoes and then dress them with fresh dill and minced red onion and oil and vinegar. Steamed or boiled asparagus are more delicate, and they're wonderful with just salt and fresh lemon. Or you could try a dressing made of olive oil, vinegar, shallot, and lots of fresh tarragon. Shavings of Parmigiano Reggiano cheese on hot or cold asparagus is sheer heaven. Or another great topping for asparagus is anchovies, sautéed in butter with lemon zest and garlic. So try asparagus this week. Just remember not to overcook them. And tune in for the next edition of Kitchen Chronicles. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, the only place you can register for kitchen essentials, non-stick, hard anodized cookware from Calphalon. It's professional quality heavy cookware with tempered glass lids and ergonomic handles. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions and is distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. We're eating out this week in a lot of different ways. We start with what might be the ultimate restaurant guidebook. It's called Chef's Night Out. The authors Karen Page and Andrew Dornenberg talk to about 100 top chefs across the country about where they love to eat on their nights off. Now, this isn't just about restaurant picks. We get into how a chef's head works, how a chef approaches eating in a new restaurant. We have a Copenhagen report from Anya von Bremsen. She says, forget the quaint little mermaid image. Copenhagen is trend central with restaurants to match. And for contrast, we head to Mongolia with writer Erica Warmbrunn, who bicycled solo from Russia to Vietnam. Finally, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. So let's get things started with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine.
Lynn, do you know what frozen custard is?
Oh, it's like soft, luscious, creamy, incredible ice cream, but I don't think I've seen decent frozen custard in 10 years.
You have to go to Milwaukee, and you have to go to Cops Custard, and you will see better than decent frozen custard. You will see the best frozen custard on the face of the earth.
I agree with you. Most soft serve ice cream is really kind of aerated whippo, and it just tastes terrible. It tastes like kind of like toxic sludge that's been, you know, put into a cone. But at Cops Custard, I mean, I'm going to really start sputtering and freaking out here. But the only way I can tell you about it is that it's just the ultimate, penultimate, vanilla, primal, ecstatic, elemental perfection of ice cream in a cone. And that's just the vanilla ice cream. If you go for the fancy flavors, then you're on a whole other level of consciousness.
You have me salivating, okay? But where is this place? It's in Milwaukee?
It's in Milwaukee. There are actually three branches of it. We like the one on Port Washington Road, and it is such a joy to walk into this place and stand at the counter and see the custard coming out of the gleaming stainless steel machines. They're, you know, clean as a whistle. And out comes this custard. It's very thick. It's very dense. It's very silky. And the density tells you just how flavorful it is. Even the vanilla has such an intense kind of dairy vanilla flavor, like you've never tasted vanilla custard before.
Well, you know, most soft-serve vanilla ice creams, if you look at them, they're kind of that dead white, like a styrofoam coffee cup. This is kind of, it's like ivory colored, like the keys of an old Steinway piano. I mean, it's beautiful to look at. And of course, if you want to gild the lily, you'll order a turtle sundae, which is their homemade fudge sauce, homemade caramel sauce, and the most delicious hand-roasted fresh pecans for on top of it, and freshly made whipped cream. Oh, I'm dying. I can't stand it.
This is really...
I'm so hungry.
You've gotten to me. But now, look, what do they do? The sort of just the basic vanilla, chocolate, that kind of stuff?
Au contraire. No, they have the basic vanilla and chocolate, but at Cops, you can count on a different flavor of custard every single day of the year.
Ooh, ooh, ooh. Tell Lynn about the French silk pie.
Well, for example.
That was my favorite.
I mean, we made notes. It was in August 2000. The special for the month was French silk pie made with Swiss chocolate custard, swirled with cream cheese custard, dotted with thick chards of dark chocolate.
And they put it in a pie crust. I mean, what's better
than
that?
You mean instead of a cone?
Yes! It's wonderful. And they also have Snickers chunky cheesecake. They have burgundy cherry. I mean, they have... Oh, it's just...
Now,
it's,
but wait, Jane is a monomaniac here, talking only about custard. And I agree, Cops custard is sensational. However, it would be a shame to go to Cops custard and not also have that wonderful, uniquely Milwaukee treat, a buttered burger.
A what?
A buttered burger. A hamburger is not enough.
Michael doesn't get enough cholesterol the custard.
No, no, no.
He needs
you have to
meat
precede
and butter
your
too.
Custard. Precede the custard with a couple of buttered burgers, maybe buttered cheeseburgers, meaning the burger is cooked and then a nice pat of butter is put on top of it while it's still warm. The buttered melts into the meat, giving it an extra succulence that you don't get from an ordinary hamburger.
The buttered burgers are good, I admit, but maybe it is my monomaniacal personality. When I go to Cops, all I want is a dish of vanilla custard ice cream. I mean, it's
you're so
it's
pure.
Zen. It's pure. I don't want all
this
pazarai in it.
I'm so glad to hear you're holding back on the saturated fat, Jane. Look, thanks, guys. I now know where to get
custard. This is my health plan.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye.
If you're feeling fancy free, come wander to the world with me. And any place we chance to be will be our rendezvous. Two for the
Jane and Michael Stern are authors of Square Meals, America's favorite comfort food cookbook. You can find their road food picks, as well as a recipe for abandoned ship ice cream in honor of Cops, on our website. That address is splendidtable.org. Anya von Bremsen writes about food and travel for Travel and Leisure magazine. She essentially roams the world checking out the local food scenes. But this isn't a case of reporting from a restaurant menu. Anya looks beyond the obvious. She puts the food of a place in its social or political context. Let's face it, nothing exists in a vacuum, especially what we eat. Anya, it's good to have you back.
Thanks, Lynn. It's great to be back.
So, Anya, what's the latest discovery?
Well, I just returned from Copenhagen. And I must say, it really blew me away, because when Americans think of Denmark, they imagine, you know, Little Mermaid, Hans Christian Andersen,
yes, exactly,
quaint little Scandinavian town. What they don't realize is that you are in one big design showroom. I mean, it's really now the coolest, hippest Northern European capital. They've just built a bridge, the Orsund Bridge, that links Sweden and Denmark. All the Swedes are there, all the Germans are there, the English, and they're looking for style. And, of course, that reflects on the restaurant scene.
So what is, I mean, when I think of eating in Copenhagen, I think of everything being smoked, pickled, you know, dilled, and delicious, but, you know, a kind of a food scene that is from 20, 30 years ago.
Well, what's actually happening all across Northern Europe, and that's even true in places as remote as Reykjavik and Oslo, young chefs are essentially cooking in this kind of very sleek international style, which means Mediterranean.
So Mediterranean in Copenhagen.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you're going to get food that is as sharp and as up-to-date as anything you'll eat in London or Berlin.
Well, give me some examples. Where should we go?
Well, the one place that that does do Nordic cuisine is a place called Passagen Spisehus, and I'm probably not pronouncing it well. And there's a very young chef, and he is an explorer at heart. So what he does, he roams around the Arctic Circle. So he might serve you a salmon chowder, a recipe for which he discovered in a Samo stronghold in northern Sweden. He'll serve you reindeer, exotic Nordic birds with lingonberry sauce, cloudberries, but that's an exception. What you usually would get is, for instance, this one restaurant called Schultz, and it's a super designed, you know, just very, very sort of sleek place. And his menu is like something you would encounter in a 2-star restaurant in Catalonia. It's just very Mediterranean. He'd serve you an intense, transparent fish soup with a scoop of parsley ice cream. And then you melt the ice cream into the soup, and it just becomes this extraordinary thing.
I'm going home and turning on the ice cream machine. But, Anya, you're talking about design. A restaurant and architecture? Any place we can go?
Yes, well, definitely that's a strong point in Copenhagen. You know, the one architect and designer that's being revived right now is a person called Arne Jacobsen. And he is a iconic mid-century modernist designer who is referred to as sometimes as the Danish Le Corbusier. And they have just recently restored a building outside of town that he built. And it has all of his original chairs, all of his original cutlery. And it's like being in a design museum. And the food, of course, is very nicely done. It's not about food, but it's,
so you can go really, and be in a designer's head and you can eat a meal at the same time.
Exactly.
Okay, so you're talking mid-century architecture, but what about new? What about contemporary?
There has been an absolute building boom in Copenhagen in the 90s. You have new airport extensions, you have additions to museum, and one of the most talked about buildings is called the Black Diamond. And it's very dramatic. It's shaped in mirrored granite. And it's the extension to the Royal Library of Copenhagen. And there is a very interesting restaurant there called Soren Ka. And Soren Ka stands for Kierkegaard. Not exactly a person you would associate with good food.
He was the philosopher, right?
It's the existential, sometimes referred to as father of existentialism.
Also not a cheerful sort.
Not a cheerful sort, famously melancholy guy. And he was really famous for attacking excess. But when he died, they discovered that he squandered his father's inheritance on these huge meals. So it's, you never know.
See, on the surface, you tell me a restaurant is named for Kierkegaard. It is not the place I am planning to have a good time.
Yeah, and it's unbelievably luminous and, again, beautifully designed. And the food is lovely. They really do amazingly interesting herring preparations. You know, that you can taste 4 or 5 different kinds of herring. And that's where the Danes still keep their Danish roots. You know, they will not give up herring.
Now you're talking to the best herring in the world, I think, I had in Copenhagen. Anya, thank you.
It was a pleasure.
Anya von Bremsen writes for Travel and Leisure magazine and is author of the award-winning book on Russian food, Please to the Table. You'll find Anya's Copenhagen picks on our website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, the ultimate restaurant guidebook, where top chefs eat on their nights off, biking across Mongolia, and we'll be opening the lines for your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions, and distributed by PRI Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family, just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week, online at Target.com. Have you ever wondered where chefs like to eat when they're not cooking in their own restaurants? Well, there's a new guidebook that tells us. It's called Chef's Night Out. Now, its authors are Karen Page and Andrew Dornenberg. Now, they interviewed top chefs all over the country to find out where they like to go. You've got hole-in-the-wall places, and you've got fancy places. But there's more. There's a section on educating your palate, and then there's another one on how to dine out like a chef. Well, Karen and Andrew have joined us in the studio. Hey, you two, welcome.
Thank you. Great
Thanks
to be here, Lynn.
Tell me, I mean, are you eating better now in restaurants after doing this book?
Are you kidding? We have not had a single bad meal since we started researching this book. And it's been a situation where we interview a chef and then we run to the restaurants in New York City where we live, or we hop on a plane and we can't wait to try the places. But from the high-end places to really small places that nobody's ever heard of that we've talked to before eating there, we've had one great meal after another.
Well, are chefs generally really critical when they go out?
Chefs are funny. They're not so critical about service and ambiance, but their palate is always on. You can't turn off your tongue, so to speak. So the consistency with what they chose with restaurants is they always chose restaurants that had really great fresh ingredients that were treated really well. So again, they may be a little more forgiving of certain things because they've always been on the other side of the stove, so to speak.
Yeah.
But when it comes to the food, it always has to be fresh and consistent and good.
Where do they tend to go? I mean, did you find many of them like to go to their competition? Or do they like to eat in hole in the walls?
Yes, yes, and yes. All of the above. I think we saw that chefs in general, you know, it's a tough business, the restaurant business. And I think chefs feel that it's part of their professional responsibility to do some research and to eat out in their city and to know what's going on. And that means going to their competitors' restaurants. But there is a real collegiality. So it's not exactly espionage here. It's more checking out, you know, what kind of ingredients people are cooking with and what kinds of techniques are being used. And there's a real camaraderie and sharing that goes on in terms of chefs educating one another that way.
It's sort of funny to find out that chefs are people, too, and the criteria they use for choosing a restaurant is like anyone else. They need to go to places where their kids like to eat or they just want to try something different. So it's all across the board with the chefs.
Were there specific things that they pick up on that were for you new? Now, Andrew, I know you're in the business. You're a caterer, aren't you?
Correct. I have my own catering company in New York.
Yeah, so in one sense, you don't count here, Andrew. Karen, tell me, Karen. Karen, no, but really, as you're looking at things through the eyes of these people who live and breathe this, were they perceiving things in a way that was new to you?
Always. I think it was interesting to see the level of respect that a lot of the chefs who cook 3- and 4-star meals across the country, who, you know, have very sophisticated palates and very sophisticated cuisines themselves, the amount of respect that they would have going into, say, an ethnic restaurant, a Vietnamese restaurant, and seeing the contrasts of flavors and textures and temperatures and how that all played off each other, and the level of sophistication that exists in a dish in some cases that might cost less than $5. So I think that was very eye-opening for me to really see that the respect for food was really so democratic that it really wasn't attached to the price tag at all. It was really based on a much more objective standard.
Did you learn anything? I mean, after eating out with all these people, was there something that can really be helpful in terms of what you learned about getting a great meal?
Well, for example, I think that different chefs have different tips depending on the cuisine. We spoke with Barbara Tropp, who's one of the leading experts in America on Chinese cuisine, and she gave us a great insider's tip to eating out in a Chinese restaurant. And, you know, typically the story goes that the non-Chinese will be offered different food from their Chinese customers of a restaurant. And the way to get the real food is to not really order off the menu, but just to ask the waiter, you know, do you have a whole steamed fish that we might be able to get? And their eyes will probably light up a little bit, because a lot of Americans don't know to order that. And then to ask for some fresh greens sauteed simply on the side. And some rice and tea, and that will get you started in a way that will help you to build a relationship with the restaurant and let them know that you really know what you're talking about and you're interested in some of the restaurant's more exotic offerings. So another point is to really look around and point. If you see something that looks interesting, ask questions. And I think slowly but surely, despite language barriers and cultural barriers, you can really build a relationship with the restaurant where next thing you know, they'll be offering you specialties that certainly don't appear on the menu.
And another important rule of thumb in a Chinese restaurant is take home your leftovers. And they find this very important because they don't like Americans who leave a bunch of food. So again, a nice show of respect is to getting everything wrapped up and taking it with you. And they'll appreciate that also. We actually had someone order something pretty weird, and she still wrapped it up and took it with her, and they smiled at her on the way out.
Huh. Andrew, out of all the people you talked to, who surprised you the most in what they liked to eat when they went out on their own?
I think Mario Batali was probably the biggest surprise, because Mario had such a wide range of restaurants that he chose. Here he is in New York, and he likes to eat, you know, hot dogs. He likes to eat in Chinatown. He likes to go to Danielle. I mean, he was just so across the board. And it's so funny, because here he is. He spends, you know, all his time cooking, you know, great Italian. He oversees a wine shop. Yet he is just, he's probably the craziest ethnic eater, you know, we met. Also, he talked about when he goes to San Francisco, he likes to go out for Mexican food. So no matter where Mario is, he has some cool restaurant to go to. And I found his palate really exciting.
I can just picture Mario Batali with, he has red clogs he wears all the time, right? And he always wears red shorts. And he wears red shorts. He's got long red hair and a ponytail, standing on a corner eating a hot dog. This is the image I will now carry with me.
With complete and utter respect. That's the beautiful thing. He talks about getting a hot dog well done so it has the caviar crunch.
The caviar crunch?
Believe it or not. It's not just any hot dog. It's a well-done hot dog.
It's a whole different way of looking at all this. Hey, you two, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much
for having us, Lynn.
Karen Page and Andrew Dornenberg are authors of Chef's Night Out, 100 Top Chefs Tell Where and How to Enjoy America's Best. Now, you can find a short list of their restaurant picks on our website. That's splendidtable.org. Right now, as we speak, in the offices of Food and Wine magazine, some momentous copy is being put together. Every year, Food and Wine magazine selects the 10 best new faces in the world of American chefs. So we've gotten the editor-in-chief of Food and Wine, Dana Cowan, to join us in the studio. Dana, welcome.
Thank you.
So, Dana, who decides on these 10 chefs?
The staff of Food and Wine magazine decides the 10, but it's after a lot of input. We get hundreds of nominations from hundreds of nominators across the country, from New York to L.A. to Alaska. And when the nominations come in, they're sorted. Some people actually qualify. Some people really don't. They've had their best friends nominate them. They've had their PR person nominate them. And those PR nominations, they're tossed out immediately. The best friend nominations, they're a little harder to figure out. But if the chef has been cooking as the number one domo in the kitchen for more than 5 years, they're tossed out too.
Now, why is that? Because they're not new anymore?
They're not new. The Food and Wine definition of best new chef, the chef has to have been cooking for 5 years or fewer as the top cook in a kitchen.
Uh-huh. So what is your criteria? Do you go out and eat at all of these restaurants?
Well, that's the good part. So we get the nominations, yeah. Then we do the qualifying, then is the selection process. And 10 editors go across the country and eat themselves silly.
Do they know you're there?
They never know. And the reason I know they never know is when I call them to give them the good news, I'll get a response like this. yow! That's fantastic. When were you guys in here? And, you know, I'll tell them, let's see, I remember that two top. I remember they had, you know, a bottle of red wine and they wouldn't have a second. I mean, these people usually keep quite close tabs on their customers.
Uh-huh. So who's going to be on the list this year?
It's a really exciting list, I think. In New York, we had Anita Lowe at Anissa, and we also had Wiley Dufresne at 71 Fresh Food, both tiny restaurants on the foodie hit list.
Mm-hmm.
In Washington, D.C., we had Frank Ruta, who's 42, so maybe he's a best not-so-young new chef. He had cooked at the White House. In Boston, we had Michael Reed, who heard the good news when he was stuck in his car in a snowstorm. He had worked with a couple of other past Best New Chefs, Todd English and Suzanne Gowen. In San Francisco, we had a popular favorite, Craig Stahl, at a restaurant called Delfina. In Chicago, there was Kelly Courtney, who is 33, and she just opened a place there last June. Also in Chicago, Sandro Gamba from Nomi, and he's 31. He grew up in Nice and has lots of great French restaurants that he's worked in, bringing that touch to the Park Hyatt Hotel. In Austin, there's Will Packwood of Amelia's, a restaurant that just opened in December, and he's a big surprise, I think. In Seattle, Washington, there's John Sundstrom at Earth and Ocean, which is in the very popular W Hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And in New Orleans, there's Randy Lewis. And he's a really big surprise because he just squeaked under the wire with a restaurant that opened just a couple of months before the nominators send in their nominations.
And that's tough because when a restaurant is very young, they're usually shaking out. So this is impressive. Dana, thank you.
Thank you.
Dana Cowan is editor-in-chief of Food & Wine magazine. Look for that chef's issue on the newsstands in June. Erica Warmbrunn doesn't travel the way most of us do. For her first trip abroad, Erica decided to bicycle from Russia to Vietnam alone. Her prime goals were to lose herself in unmapped landscapes and to meet the people who inhabited them. Her trip took 8 months, and much of that time was in Mongolia. Erica describes Mongolia as this land that's harsh and beautiful and a place of great extremes. Little grows there. Most Mongolians live as nomads. They herd sheep, goats, yaks, and horses. Just imagine what she saw.
I had been on the road for 2 weeks when I arrived in Khatgal, bicycling through Mongolia on a journey that would end 8 months later in southern Vietnam. I was told I would starve in Mongolia, but people just keep feeding me. Every time I walked into a home in Mongolia, I ate. I ate tart new yogurt, I ate curdled milk sun-dried to the hardness of a lollipop and called arol. I ate orom, the solid cream that forms on the top of boiled milk as it cools. I looked at family photo albums and drank mare's milk fermented into irak, a tangy, slightly alcoholic brew reminiscent of thin buttermilk. I drank arhi, homemade alcohol distilled from cow's milk to a clear liquid and dubbed Mongolian vodka. And I ate mutton. Mutton and noodles, mutton and potatoes, mutton and rice, plain boiled mutton, gnawing on the meat while my hosts also devoured every bit of gristle and fat, their strong teeth and sharp knives leaving behind only naked, glistening bone. On my first night in Mongolia, in a tiny hotel restaurant, a bowl of weak, stale bouillon had been served with my dinner. I was unsure what to do with it. I had a fork, but no spoon. So finally I decided it was probably all right to drink straight from the small bowl, like from a large teacup in a Chinese restaurant. Tea. Of course. It wasn't soup at all. It was tea. Salty Mongolian tea. A week or so later, in a home in Khovsgol province, I was offered another bowl of tea. A woman held it in her right hand, the fingertips of her left hand resting lightly beneath her right forearm. I carefully touched the fingers of my left hand to my right elbow, then reached out to accept the small bowl, cupping the bottom in four fingers, my thumb just below the rim for balance. I watched people carefully in Mongolia, watched their gestures, trying to learn, trying not to offend, trying not to look as big and awkward as I felt. I had already learned not to hold a tea bowl with various fingers splayed around the sides and an index finger crooked over the rim. I had learned that all food and drink must be served and received with two hands. In the absence of language, ritual becomes a way of communication, of making yourself a little less foreign. New customs cease to be quaint or primitive or exotic and become touchstones, tiny doors into a new culture. Using both hands when receiving food or drink had quickly become as normal as taking off my shoes in a Russian home, not touching the fruit in an Italian shop, or taking a bottle of wine with me to a party in America. Snow fringed the distant mountains, and a crisp edge of frost hung on the air as I pedaled into the village of Tassensengel. A family sat chatting in front of their yard. Zochit Budel? I asked. Hotel? Bachkwe, replied one of the men. No. Bachkwe? I repeated. Bachkwe, he confirmed. Ah, I nodded, looking off at the hills, but making no move to leave. Then came the words I had been waiting for. Tsao? Tea? I already knew that once I was inside a home drinking tea, I had a place to stay for the night. The family multiplied quickly after my arrival. Brothers, cousins, grandparents, friends, and neighbors crowded around, watching me. They served me a delicacy, a sheep's tail, a 4-inch-long, bumpy glob of white fat quivering nakedly in a bowl. I nervously ignored the opaque blob. Pure fat was the one thing I would never learn to stomach. And eventually someone removed it and replaced it with a steaming bowl full of the delicious mutton noodle soup called Gorultai Shul. Late in the evening, my host presented me with a bulging bag of arl. I gave him a pen from Seattle in which a little plastic elevator climbed up and down the space needle, explaining that I could see this tower from my home. He then gave me a pocket-sized notebook with his address inscribed in the front cover. I in turn gave his teenage daughter a roll of wintergreen lifesavers, which she accepted in two cupped palms. She undid the foil and gave one to her little brother, who screamed and spit the candy out, his shocked eyes darting from me to his big sister and back, the mint too sharp on his tongue in a land of no spices. The next morning, the family matriarch said she loved me. She said thank you. Thank me. But she was thanking me simply for being there, for wanting to be, as much as a one-night stranger with a 30-word vocabulary could be, a part of her life and world. And I in turn thanked her whole family, for the depth of a hospitality they didn't know was special, for sharing their home with me, for taking me into their world as if I belonged.
Writer Erica Warmbrunn is the author of Where the Pavement Ends. She says she still misses her bicycle, named Green. Well, it's time for our trivia challenge of the week. Now, this week's trivia question is about salmon. What's the difference between lox, Nova lox, and smoked salmon? We'll be back in a moment with that answer, and we'll be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions, and distributed by PRI Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We'll be opening the lines for your calls in a minute, so give us a ring. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia question. It was about the ways you can preserve salmon. The question was, what's the difference between lox, Nova Lox, and smoked salmon? Well, to get the answer to this one, I went to the salmon maven of New York City. He's Mark Russ Fetterman. His family started the great Lower East Side deli called Russ and Daughters back in the early 1900s. He sells tons of preserved salmon each year. According to Mark, lox is simply salmon preserved in a wet salt brine, maybe flavored with some sugar and spices. It's never smoked. Nova lox usually is salmon that's brine cured like regular lox, but then it's cold smoked. Cold smoked means it's put in a smoky chamber for hours at a temperature of about 78 degrees. Now this gets us to the two kinds of smoked salmon. Cold smoked salmon is the fancy stuff from Scotland and Europe. It's just like Nova lox, except it's rubbed with a dry salt cure and then smoked. And essentially, we eat it raw, thin sliced. Hot smoked salmon is cured the same way, but the difference is in the smoking. The temperature is higher, so the fish actually cooks in the smoke. So now you can step up to that deli counter with great confidence. The lines are officially open. You can get to us at 800-537-5252, and we'll talk. We'll take a shot at just about anything you want to talk about. Let's see who has been waiting. We have Susan on the line. So, Susan, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Lynn?
I am doing swell. What is there some pressing topic you want to discuss, or shall we just schmooze?
Oh, well, wait, let's schmooze food. This specific food thing.
Okay.
I have been broiling salmon in a sort of China type, you know, porcelain kind of what I thought was a broiling dish.
Mm-hmm.
And it was maybe 2 to 3 inches deep. And, you know, life was good. I put a little oil, a little salt and pepper, a little vermouth right at the bottom, right under the flame, and a little sort of drawer thing that pulls out from under the oven.
Oh, yeah, the thing you always get down on your belly to adjust. Yes,
exactly.
I know what you mean. Yes, exactly.
And it was great. The fish got really nice and browned on top, and it was moist on the inside.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, I had done this. I pulled out the drawer. I was about to get my oven mitts to pick it up, and I hear this loud noise, and it breaks.
Mm.
And I thought, well, that's kind of scary. Maybe that's dangerous.
Oh,
so
tacky.
I go to the
Very
store,
tacky.
I say, what should I do? They say, get a metal one.
Right.
I get a metal one, and lo and behold, it doesn't get nice and brown. When I broil the salmon, it doesn't get nice and brown on top. It just cooks through. It's not moist in the bottom, in the middle. All the vermouth evaporates. Just unsatisfactory. So my question is, in terms of both safety and taste, what is the best material and what's the best sort of height for a broiling dish?
This is a real challenge. You've obviously put a lot of thought into this, and I'm embarrassed to say I haven't. All right. Now, let's do this now. Let's think about this now. What color was that dish?
White.
That's what I thought. It was reflecting heat.
Oh.
What color is that? What color is the metal? Black?
It's sort of silver, actually.
Well, it should be reflecting.
Uh-huh.
You should have a reflective thing. I understand what you're saying. You want something that's going to hold in that moisture, because you said it was, what, 2 inches high or so around the sides?
Two or three, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So you were broiling in essentially a shallow baking dish.
But it wasn't real shallow, like the kind of thing you make creme brulee in.
No, but we would call it a shallow baking
okay.
dish. You know, the technical term among we professionals.
Okay.
But the point is, you had more reflection going on, and also the size of that dish was probably pretty close to the sides of your salmon.
Uh-huh.
So you didn't have a lot of evaporation of moisture.
Okay.
You know,
yes.
So if you put it in a vast pan,
right.
The moisture is going to evaporate much quicker.
Right.
Is the metal pan about the same size?
About the same size. It's much thinner, though.
Oh, heat conduction.
Okay.
The heat isn't staying.
the heat isn't moving and working in the same way, because that ceramic, believe it or not, does hold the heat.
Right.
And probably this pan, maybe it's stainless steel.
Yes.
I'll bet you there's not holding a bit of heat. Okay, here's what might help you.
Okay.
If you could get something the same size, about the same height as what your original pan was about, mm-hmm. your ceramic piece was, and you could get it in aluminum, believe it or not, and thick aluminum, mm-hmm. and you could even, I mean, if it's lined with stainless steel, all the better. But really what you want is thick aluminum, because you have heat conduction, and it's going to hold the heat. See, stainless steel is a crummy conductor of heat.
Mm-hmm.
The heat just passes right through it. And probably, for whatever reason, whatever magic was going on with that ceramic dish that you had, it was coddling that salmon, and evidently the stainless steel just is not doing it.
Okay.
So that would be one solution. And by the way, one of the tricky things with ceramic is when it really gets exposed to very high heat, it does break.
Okay.
It really does. And that's the danger. You know, it's sort of like 10 salmons will work, and then the last one,
right,
your dish is toast.
Right.
And it's so hard eating those splinters.
Yeah.
You know, so but really what I do is look for a good heat conducting dish.
Uh-huh.
And it's still not the ideal. I mean, it sounds like you really, I was wondering.
Pyrex, I know, for example, says that it's for baking, not broiling.
Yes, because Pyrex will snap.
Uh-huh.
I'm just thinking what other material is out there. You know what might be interesting to try? Enameled cast iron.
Huh.
And Le Creuset. Uh-huh. Are the great classic makers of that. And it's heavy and it's thick and it conducts heat and it works really nicely.
But enamel cast iron should be safe under the broiler?
Oh, yes, yes, absolutely, okay. Absolutely. But see how it works for you.
Okay.
But just remember, that size was one of the great keys for you.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
We will let us know how this all works out. All right.
A lot.
This is the ongoing saga of the broiler dish, but I understand the problem. Well, we're taking your calls this hour at 800-537-5252. I think this is a good time to tell you that we're also going to do an online chat a couple of Mondays from now, April the 23rd at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. It's just another opportunity for us to talk. Now, you can get more details on our website. That's splendidtable.org. Okay, let's get back to the landlines. Let's see who's up. It's Catherine. Hey, Catherine, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Yes, hello. I'm in a great quandary. I've been trying to find some recipes for fried rice. So I have a four-part question, and I feel your answers, they will give me the best fried rice I've ever made.
Gee, so, Catherine, nothing like pressure. You've been planning for this call, haven't you?
Well, I've been searching for a recipe for months.
Oh, okay.
One, when making fried rice, should the rice be cooked or should it be raw? Two, again, when frying,
yes,
should you use olive oil, peanut oil, regular oil, or some Asian oil that I might not be aware of?
These are great questions. Okay, go on.
Three, okay, when adding the eggs to fried rice,
right,
should you drop it in the rice when it's really hot and cooking, so it's almost like egg drop soup type of cooking, or
right,
do you scramble it on the side and then add it cooked? Right.
You know, I like a thoughtful cook. Okay, what's question number four?
And four, I know you can have all kinds of ingredients to make it, you know, different each time you make it.
Yeah.
What are some of the most favorite spices to add to fried rice?
Okay. All right. Now, number one, first question, do you cook the rice? Yes. In fact, fried rice, Chinese experts may disagree with me on this, but my impression has always been fried rice is a dish that came out of using leftover rice. You see, so you want some steamed rice, cooked rice. Then long grain is usually what's used, but it could even be a short grain. Short grain tends to be a little, you know, chunkier.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so question number two was, what kind of oil do you use? If you're doing it in the true Chinese style, the traditional Asian style, you wouldn't use olive oil because there are no olives, or if there are, nobody's talked a lot about them, mm-hmm. you know, in Asia. And usually what people like to use is a peanut oil or some kind of vegetable oil. That's number two. Number three was about the egg, right?
Yes.
Generally what is done is toward the end of, and you're really stir frying the rice. The idea with fried rice is you get the oil hot, you get the wok hot, first of all, or a big saute pan. You sprinkle the oil in get that hot. You drop in the ingredients that you're going to stir fry with the rice. And some of the favorite things are things like diced ham, perhaps some scallion, ginger, garlic. People like peas, but it's really sometimes there's fresh shrimp that you would stir fry. And then they put in the rice just to get it hot. Perhaps a little bit of liquid, some flavored liquid like a broth or a little dry sherry or rice wine. Stir fry, and then the last thing that you do is you have beaten up eggs that you toss in with the hot rice right in the wok, and they'll look like threads of scrambled egg by the time you get done. So the egg goes in raw. And as far as the spicing and the seasoning, now everybody's taking off in 10 directions, you know, with Asian dishes. But some of the traditional things would be ginger and garlic that you stir fry initially in the oil and it flavors the oil. There could be a small amount of chili. You could add something like oyster sauce or soy sauce. So does that give you the idea? Does that help you?
Yes, but you brought up something that brings up another question, number five.
Okay.
The ginger root. I'm so intimidated by that ginger root in the grocery store. I see it there. I know people use it. I don't know how to use it.
Oh, don't be frightened. It's all right.
Intimidated.
You don't have to be intimidated, Catherine. It's okay. The idea with ginger root is it's a pungent, spicy, very refreshing kind of flavor. And the way you generally use it is you just peel off the outside skin and you do thin slices and you mince them. And I'd say if you had, let's say, 3 cups of rice, you'd probably take 3 or 4 thin slices, about a 16th of an inch thin slices, you know, small rounds of the ginger root, and mince that up. If you wanted to season gently with the ginger root, what you would do is just throw the whole slices into the oil, saute them for a few moments, pull them out. And then you just have this very gentle ginger flavor. You store ginger root, in an airtight bag or even loosely, you know, put into something that would be like a saran wrap in the coldest part of the fridge. And the other thing you can do with it is you could peel it and slice it and freeze it and then just break off what you need. Yeah. Or you could store it in sherry or at some kind of alcohol, and it keeps for quite a long time. Don't be afraid of it. It's a delicious, sprightly, slightly spicy, but never hot, never offensively hot seasoning. Okay?
Yes. Thank you very much.
Out of curiosity,
yes.
What do you do for a living?
I work for the Memphis Area Chamber of Commerce. I'm the Director of Technology Business Development.
This explains it.
What?
Well, you're very exacting, and it's wonderful. I mean, you know exactly what you want, and you've organized it in your mind, and this is great.
Well, thank you. I will take that as a compliment.
It is a compliment, Catherine. If you ever decide you want to run my life, give a call.
All right. Hey. Well, thank you very much. And I do listen to you every weekend when I'm at the office at work.
Hey, thank you.
All right. Have
take
a great
care.
Day. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. I worry about her working weekends. Oh, well. But by the way, just a little thing about ginger. You know, ginger root is something that I think can intimidate a lot of people. And it's the easiest thing in the world to work with. And one of the great things, especially if you have a tummy ache, two things. If you have a tummy ache or if you'd like to do a very easy, great flavoring combination, you take about 2 inches of the ginger root, peel it, cut it into chunks, take about 4 cloves of garlic, throw them together in a blender. And either drop that into simmering chicken broth, because it'll act as a wonderful quieter of your system. It'll help get rid of any ailments you might have as well. The other thing is, if you drop it into a little bit of soy sauce and dunk a piece of fish in it and grill it, you've got the best flavoring in the world. If you'd like to talk, if you've got any questions, you can reach us at 800-537-5252. We have John on the line. So, John, what pressing issue do you want to discuss?
Well, I was having a discussion with my girlfriend over the health value and health risk between sushi and pickled herring. Coming from a Scandinavian background as I do, I'll have a soft spot, I would say, for eating pickled herring. And her concern, of course, is what value is that for you, given the discussion around the health risk and such with sushi?
All right. A, this isn't my area of expertise. B,
but that has never stopped me from offering an opinion.
I've noticed.
Thank you, John. I'll hope that's a compliment.
Yeah, it is.
It brings up this whole issue about very ancient ways of preserving foods. You know, salting, brining, smoking, drying, and pickling.
Yes.
And essentially, pickled herring is herring, which is a very fatty fish, that is salted first and then usually immersed in something very acidic, like vinegar. And usually that's what it is. Sometimes it's actually, in the past, alcohol has been used as well. And then its flavorings are added, and it might be sugar, it might be spices, etc. But essentially, it is this idea of a very ancient way of preserving foods. Now, the big question is, if there are any parasites, things that we may not see with the naked eye, but if there's any organism in the flesh of that fish that is potentially harmful, or if the fish has been exposed to waters that are polluted, would all of that treatment make any difference, and would it make it safer? Again, I'm not a scientist, but from the little bit I know about the subject, no, I don't think it would. It's possible that deep pickling might knock out some parasites, but if pollutants were in that flesh, I don't think it would make a big difference. I think it's a matter of, it's a little bit of Russian roulette. But if the fish is coming from very deep water, you know, far from coasts, then you're probably safer because there's just less chance of pollution going on.
It's usually an Icelandic herring that is the best, of course. Given that location, you can, as it's described in the name, you can imagine it is deep water fish.
And it's also cold water fish. And cold water tends to harbor fewer microbes that are potentially dangerous. But is it absolutely safe? No, I don't think it is. Then again, is there any food that's absolutely safe? Nothing. Nothing that I can think of has total assurance. When it comes to raw seafood, as in sashimi and sushi, that's a tricky one. These days, I think it's pretty tricky. Someone can be extremely scrupulous and careful, but if you're eating deep sea fish and you're going to, you're eating it in that it's been handled by someone who's a real expert, you're probably pretty much okay. But I'd be very careful. And when I see sushi being sold in supermarkets, I don't like doing that. I like to, my sushi is usually things like cooked fish or vegetables or pickled vegetables, that kind of stuff. I love
right.
it. I love it. It's a craft that fascinates me and it's delicious. But I don't do a lot of raw seafood. Mm-hmm. Okay?
Great. Well, thank you very much. Enjoy your show immensely.
Thanks, John. And now you may want to call an expert.
There we go.
Hey, thank you for calling. Great question. Great question. Okay, well, that's the show for this week, guys. Thanks for joining us, and remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with some sound advice. If you can't be a good example, then you'll just have to be a horrible warning. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, where you'll find an exclusive selection of Corningware bakeware, including the classic French white line. Corningware can go from the freezer to the oven to the dinner table. To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to The Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota 55101. That's The Splendid Table, care of NPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. Our associate producers are Jennifer Lubke and Jennifer Russell. Our theme music was composed by Billy Barber. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Public Radio International.